Chapter 9. The Education of John Park Custis. Love goes toward love as schoolboys from their books, but love from love toward school with heavy looks. William Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet. Years would pass from the time Jackie Custis came to Mount Vernon until he was old enough to read and appreciate the fine library his grandfather had assembled. But George Washington understood the importance of putting books into his stepson's hands as early as possible. He also understood the importance of teaching his stepdaughter, Patsy, to read. In January 1760, Washington spent 1 shilling 6 pence on books for the two children. That November, the month Jackie turned 6, he spent 5 more shillings on books for him and his sister. The following year, Washington hired a domestic tutor to live at Mount Vernon and guide the studies of both children. He found an able tutor in Walter McGowan. McGowan's background before he came to Mount Vernon is a mystery. Some say he came from Scotland, but this supposed identity derives from a heated remark the Reverend Jonathan Boucher made in a moment of spite when he called McGowan a raw Scotchman. A derogatory epithet, the phrase raw Scotchman means roughly the same as country bumpkin. It need not be taken literally. Other evidence suggests that McGowan was born in Ireland and emigrated to Virginia in his youth. He was in his mid-20s when he came to Mount Vernon to tutor the Custis children. Regretting his own educational deficiencies, Washington sought for his stepson the kind of proper gentleman's education that circumstances had denied him. At Washington's request, McGowan designed a rigorous program of study for Jackie Custis. Before McGowan's arrival, Washington had introduced the boy to the language of Caesar. Describing Jackie's knowledge of Latin, Washington, with a tinge of hyperbole, wrote, "He began the study of it as soon as he could speak." 18th-century students typically learned the rudiments of Latin before undertaking Greek. McGowan initially planned for Jackie to start learning Greek while quite young. Perhaps Washington exaggerated the boy's early exposure to Latin in an effort to accelerate his education, or perhaps McGowan devised an innovative scheme to teach Latin and Greek simultaneously. The year Jackie turned 8, McGowan asked Washington to order several schoolbooks, including Alexander Dunlop's Greek Grammar, Benjamin Hedrich's Greek Lexicon, and some reading texts in Greek, including an edition of the works of lyric poet Anacreon and the New Testament. The absence of Latin texts from this list reflects McGowan's belief that the Latin library of Jackie's grandfather would be sufficient for his grandson's education. Along with the Greek works, McGowan also ordered textbooks in many other subjects: bookkeeping, geography, history, and Roman antiquities. The order reveals much about McGowan's educational approach. He believed that teaching ancient languages in isolation was insufficient. They should be taught in conjunction with related subjects. Attention to Roman antiquities could supplement the study of Latin. Knowledge of ancient history could enhance the study of both Latin and Greek. Though the classical languages formed the core of the 18th-century gentleman's education, McGowan understood the value of teaching practical subjects. Since Custis would inherit a large, complex estate, he would need basic bookkeeping skills. Though well-founded, McGowan's educational scheme proved too ambitious for an 8-year-old boy, especially one as indolent and easily distracted as Jackie Custis. The study of Greek would have to wait. The schoolbooks Washington obtained for his stepson a year and a half later indicate a major shift in McGowan's pedagogical approach. Perhaps a grandfather's books were unsuitable for a grandson's education. Jackie needed more basic textbooks. In 1764, the year his stepson turned 10, Washington purchased from the office of the Virginia Gazette copies of James Greenwood's London Vocabulary and The Preceptor, an all-purpose textbook compiled by London editor and publisher Robert Dodsley. This same year, he also ordered Erasmus's Colloquies. James Greenwood, the same Greenwood whose English grammar Washington had studied in his youth, compiled the London Vocabulary to introduce students to Latin. According to the title page of this textbook, Greenwood took an approach to teaching Latin that follows Johann Amos Comenius's centuries-old Orbis Pictus, the first illustrated reading book printed in Europe. Greenwood's London Vocabulary presents a series of chapters treating natural phenomena and physical objects. Illustrations introduce many of the chapters, which consist of explanatory texts presented in English and Latin in parallel columns. The work remained a popular schoolbook through the colonial period, though the title irked some revolutionary parents. The first American edition of the London Vocabulary was retitled The Philadelphia Vocabulary. The dialogues that form Erasmus's Colloquies had been a cornerstone of Latin education for centuries. New selections gave them a contemporary flair. The edition prepared by English schoolmaster John Clark appealed to more students in 18th-century America than any other. To make the educational process as delightful as possible, Clark deliberately selected Erasmus's most comical dialogues. Erasmus had the power to entertain students as they learned. Using lively repartee and vivid description, his dialogues develop character and incident in a manner that looks forward to the novel. 2.5 years later, Jackie's Latin education had progressed far enough for him to resume his study of Greek. Shortly after his stepson's 12th birthday, Washington ordered an up-to-date Greek grammar. As Jackie began learning Greek, he continued his Latin education, reading Virgil while working through the Greek grammar and dipping into the Greek Testament. McGowan remained at Mount Vernon to tutor Jackie and Patsy Custis until the Christmas holidays in 1767, when he would visit England to receive holy orders. Since the entirety of British North America formed part of the Diocese of London, colonial candidates for the Anglican ministry had to go to England to be ordained by the Bishop of London. While supporting his decision, Washington was upset that McGowan quit teaching the Custis children in December, but did not depart until March, leaving them without a teacher for months. Patsy could continue reading at home under her mother's tutelage, but Jackie needed a new teacher with expertise in the classics. Before going to England, McGowan apparently recommended Jonathan Boucher. Besides serving as rector of St. Mary's Parish in Caroline County, Boucher, like many colonial Virginia clergymen, also ran a boarding school to supplement his clerical salary. In late May, Washington wrote Boucher to ask if he would accept Jackie as a student at his school, located about 6 miles from Fredericksburg. He described his stepson as a boy of good genius, about 14 years of age, untainted in his morals, and of innocent manners. Washington exaggerated Jackie's age. It would be nearly 6 months before he turned 14. Furthermore, he offered to pay Boucher an extra 10 or 12 pounds a year to provide special care, telling him Jackie was a promising boy, the last of his family, and will possess a very large fortune. The part about the large fortune piqued Boucher's interest. He knew how to turn a wealthy student to his advantage. Washington had not necessarily mentioned Jackie's wealth to secure his acceptance to Boucher's school. He mentioned it to stress the danger inherited wealth possesses for immature boys. The letter reveals Washington's anxiety. He told Boucher that he wanted to make Jackie fit for more useful purposes than a horse racer. Washington feared his stepson would end up like so many other sons of wealthy parents, as a wastrel who had run through his fortune while accomplishing little in life. When it came to Jackie Custis, Washington's concerns were well-founded. Jackie arrived at Boucher's boarding school that June with two horses and a slave named Julius. Somehow he carelessly neglected to bring one essential, his Greek grammar. Jackie's neglect augurs the direction his studies would take. Washington accompanied Jackie to school to meet his new teacher. Boucher was an odd-looking fellow. His future wife found him a mass of contradictions. In person, inelegant and clumsy, yet not rough and disgusting, of a dark complexion and with large but not forbidding features, of a thoughtful yet cheerful aspect, with a penetrating eye and a turn of countenance that invites confidence and begets affection. Manners often awkward, yet always interesting. Perfectly untaught and unformed, conformable to no rules, yet never unpolite. Incapable of making a bow like a gentleman, yet far more incapable of thinking, speaking, or acting in a manner unbecoming a gentleman. Never knew a person of so low an origin and breeding, with so high and improved a mind. A thorough gentleman as to internals and essentials, though often lamentably deficient in outward forms. Regardless of Boucher's unusual appearance and strange mannerisms, Washington found him satisfactory. Over dinner on Thursday, June 30, 1768, they discussed Jackie's education. No record of their dinner conversation survives, but the two men reached an agreement regarding the direction Jackie's studies should take. A half-dozen years earlier, Boucher had drafted a treatise defending the value of a traditional education based on the study of Greek and Latin. His treatise, which circulated in manuscript, prompted James Morey, Thomas Jefferson's teacher, to refute what Boucher said. Morey questioned whether a classical education was essential for American students. Many other educational theorists of the 18th century would broach the issue. In Proposals Relating to the Education of Youth in Pennsylvania, 1749, the document that would lead to the formation of the Philadelphia Academy, University of Pennsylvania, Benjamin Franklin similarly questioned the value of a classical education. Washington insisted his stepson pursue a traditional education based on the classics, the same kind of education his brother Lawrence had received at the Appleby School. A staunch believer in the value of hard work, Washington also wanted to make sure Jackie's new teacher provided a demanding program of study. Boucher agreed to keep Washington informed of his stepson's progress. Discussing Jackie Custis's educational difficulties, Washington and Boucher would exchange numerous letters in the coming years. Though previously unrecognized as such, their correspondence forms a significant contribution to the history of American education. As the two men grappled with the problem of Jackie Custis, both would question the basic process of education. Soon after Jackie arrived, Boucher realized the boy needed additional books to continue his study. Upon learning of the fine Custis Library at Mount Vernon, Boucher requested two Latin works in particular. His request gave Washington the opportunity to delve into parts of the Custis collection he had not examined since cataloging the library at Mount Vernon 4 years earlier. Boucher asked for Cicero's De Officiis and Livy's History of Rome. His need for these particular works reveals much about the state of Jackie's education. Livy was typically taught late in a boy's Latin education, usually after Virgil. Since Custis had been reading Virgil with McGowan, Boucher intended to pick up where his predecessor had left off. As a textbook, Cicero's De Officiis could do double duty. A classic of moral philosophy, as well as a model of Latin prose, De Officiis could be used to teach both ethics and composition. Washington searched the Mount Vernon library and found the copy of Cicero's De Officiis, but he could not find Livy. He forwarded Cicero to Boucher, along with the Greek grammar Jackie had forgotten. Within a month of Jackie Custis's arrival, his new teacher had a fair understanding of the boy's limitations. Boucher understood that Jackie, or Jack as he now preferred, had neither the talent nor the desire to become an accomplished classical scholar. Instead of admitting his inability to teach the boy and thus losing such a wealthy student, Boucher turned his back on the classical education he held dear. In a progress report to Washington, Boucher de-emphasized the classical curriculum to stress the value of a well-rounded education, one that aimed to create people who are both wise and good, that sought not only to cultivate the understanding, but to expand the heart, to ameliorate the temper, and fix the generous purpose in the glowing breast. Boucher often showed off his reading in his letters, using literary references for rhetorical effect. His watchwords here come from the spring section of James Thomson's philosophical poem, The Seasons. In a celebrated passage, Thomson stresses the joy of teaching. Delightful task! To rear the tender thought, to teach the young idea how to shoot, to pour the fresh instruction o'er the mind, to breathe the enlivening spirit, and to fix the generous purpose in the glowing breast. Before Custis had completed his third month at Boucher's school, he took a break from his studies and returned to Mount Vernon. He lingered there, nursing an illness, staying even longer after his mother fell ill. Martha Washington indulged herself by keeping her son nearby throughout her own illness. The situation reflects the difficulty Washington faced as a stepfather, the difficulty all stepfathers face. He wanted to discipline his stepson when necessary, but he could only go so far without upsetting the boy's mother. Embarrassed by Jack's lengthy absence from school, Washington wrote a letter to Boucher in October, apologizing for keeping him so long and conveying his stepson's promise to focus on his studies. He now promises to stick close to his book and endeavor by diligent study to recover his lost time. He will have nothing, that we know of, to interrupt him till the intervention of the Christmas holidays, when you will please to give him leave to return home. This letter reveals a pattern of behavior Jack Custis would repeat throughout his time at Boucher's school. He would slack off, promise his stepfather that he would concentrate on his studies, and then slack off again. Washington appears to take his stepson at his word in this October letter, but gradually he would recognize the boy's promises to shape up as empty ones. Jack returned to Mount Vernon at Christmas and stayed for over a month. The growing family crisis tempered the holiday festivities this year. Jack's sister, Patsy, had shown signs of epilepsy when she was 6 years old, but in 1768 she suffered her first grand mal seizure. Her seizures subsequently became more frequent. Patsy's epilepsy created constant worry and she required continual attention. None of the medical books in the Custis Library could help. There was no known cure for epilepsy. A steady stream of doctors with an assortment of medicinal remedies visited Mount Vernon in the coming years. When both medical books and physicians proved ineffective, Washington resorted to a folk remedy, having a local blacksmith fashion an iron ring for Patsy to wear to guard against seizures. According to tradition, iron could work magic, but needless to say, Patsy's new ring did nothing to cure her illness. McGowan, now the Reverend Walter McGowan, returned to Virginia in time to celebrate the holidays at Mount Vernon in 1768. This Christmas he brought presents in the form of books. On his departure for England earlier that year, Washington had allowed McGowan to spend up to £40 sterling to purchase sundry books for Jack. Shortly after the holidays, McGowan left Virginia for Maryland to become rector of St. James Parish, Anne Arundel County, the same parish Boucher had been maneuvering to obtain for himself. Boucher was understandably upset upon learning that McGowan had taken the position he wanted. It was Boucher's jealousy on this occasion that led to his derogatory, raw Scotchman remark. The two men reconciled in the coming years. On at least one occasion, they came together at Mount Vernon. Custis's lengthy absence from school forced Washington to write Boucher another letter of apology. Washington seems less certain about his stepson's dedication to his studies in this January letter than he had in the October one. After so long a vacation, we hope Jackie will apply close to his studies and retrieve the hours he has lost from his book since your opening school. He promises to do so, and I hope he will. Having a slave at his beck and call, especially one as eager to please as Julius, Jack could indulge his distractions. Washington and Boucher agreed that Julius had to go. After Washington replaced him with Joe, a more serious and strong-minded servant, his stepson shaped up considerably. By mid-July 1769, Boucher could hope that Jack's laziness was not incurable. Boucher took advantage of the Custis fortune by overcharging for the maintenance of Jack's horses. Washington readily paid for their upkeep, essentially telling Boucher to spend what he needed without bothering him with such trivialities. Boucher took further advantage, submitting to Washington a list of 50 books that he claimed Jack needed for his studies. The list named several standard Latin authors and some rudimentary Greek textbooks, which duplicate ones Jack already owned. Overall, the list suggests that Boucher had planned an ambitious program of study for Jack Custis. Some of the listed titles seem less like textbooks for students and more like books Boucher wished to read himself. Regardless, Washington diligently ordered them. After the books arrived at Mount Vernon, they took an inordinate amount of time to reach the school, much to Boucher's consternation. The most significant work among these new books was the 20-volume duodecimo edition of Cicero, published by Faulis in Glasgow, with notes by the Abbé d'Olivet. Described by Boucher as a very neat edition, the Faulis Cicero was handsomely printed in large, legible type. Nothing indicates whether the beautiful typography motivated Jack to broaden his knowledge of Cicero. The set has since been broken up. Its 20th volume, the only one known to survive, contains no evidence indicating whether he read it. Boucher devised another way to benefit from the Custis fortune. As a capstone to Jack's education, he planned a grand tour of Europe for the boy, with himself as guide, of course. Pitching the idea to Washington, Boucher said the grand tour would form an excellent part of Jack's education, not only in itself, but also to motivate his study beforehand. The promise of the trip, Boucher argued, would stimulate Jack to pursue his studies with greater earnestness when he recollects how often he must be put to the blush if he appears illiterate amongst men of letters into whose company in traveling. In other words, as Jack prepared for the trip, he would finally realize the importance of a good education and pursue his studies with renewed vigor. The reasoning of Jack's teacher seemed backwards to his stepfather. Though Washington admitted that travel could help to form the manners and increase the knowledge of observant youth, he did not believe that dangling a European vacation carrot-wise in front of his stepson would motivate the boy. Instead, Jack should master his studies before ever being promised a lavish journey to Europe. He should not travel through Europe until he was sufficiently instructed in classical knowledge. Washington did not forbid the trip altogether, but asked Boucher to sketch out his plan more fully. Boucher was relieved that Washington did not reject his travel plan outright. Had he insisted Jack complete his classical education before embarking on a grand tour, Boucher knew the trip would never happen. Lately, Jack's education was making almost no progress whatsoever. To convince Washington of the advantages travel would have for his stepson, Boucher brought his rhetorical skills to bear. The detailed letter he wrote on May 21, 1770, to explain the advantages of travel, cleverly uses literary allusion, direct discourse, and figurative comparison to make its point. Boucher compared the untraveled person to the Caribbee Indian that Joseph-Francois Lafitteau mentions. Offended at being called a savage, Lafitteau's Indian exclaims, "I know no savages but the Europeans, who adopt none of our customs." Furthermore, Boucher cleverly alluded to Baron Thunder Ten Tronck, the father of Cunegonde in Voltaire's Candide. People who never travel, Boucher argued, have a severely limited perspective. They suppose, like the Baron Thunder Ten Tronck, that both his country and countrymen are the finest of all possible countries and people. Alluding to a character from Candide, Boucher apparently assumed Washington knew the work. He could have. Candide was fairly well known in colonial Virginia. Patrick Henry, for one, had a copy in his library. So did Colonel William Fleming. Boucher's letter was persuasive enough that Washington agreed to give the planned journey further thought and sought the advice of several friends in Williamsburg. Soon after his May 21st letter to Washington, Boucher made arrangements to move to Annapolis, where he would become rector of St. Anne's Church. He also planned to relocate his school to Annapolis and hoped Custis would move to Annapolis to continue his studies. Now 15, Jack was more than willing to move. His stepfather viewed the prospect with trepidation. At Boucher's rural school in Caroline County, Jack had comparatively few temptations. But Annapolis was a dangerous place for a wealthy lad with an absence of personal resolve. Despite his stepfather's misgivings, Jack moved to Annapolis in late July. Within a matter of months, Washington noticed a change in the boy, and not for the better. Not only was he not studying, he had dropped all pretense of study. His mind, in his stepfather's words, seemed a good deal relaxed from study and more than ever turned to dogs, horses, and guns. In addition, Jack was becoming something of a dandy, developing an obsession for clothes and other fineries. Washington wrote Boucher, urging him to redouble his efforts to keep the boy's education on track. "I must beg the favor of you, therefore, to keep him close to those useful branches of learning which he ought now to be acquainted with, and as much as possible under your own eye." If Boucher could not assure him of Jack's progress and dedication to study, Washington would remove him from school. Boucher responded with frankness. He cautioned Washington that Jack, in addition to his laziness, was displaying signs of interest in the opposite sex that seemed inappropriate for a 15-year-old. Boucher was apprehensive about Jack's love of ease and love of pleasure, pleasure of a kind exceedingly uncommon at his years. He continued, "I must confess to you I never did in my life know a youth so exceedingly indolent or so surprisingly voluptuous. One would suppose nature had intended him for some Asiatic prince." By the time another Christmas rolled around, Washington saw that Jack had made almost no progress in his study of Greek. Were he to insist that Jack continue studying ancient languages, Washington realized, he would be taking time for more practical fields of learning. Sadly, his dream of giving Jack the classical education of a proper gentleman had failed to come true. If he were to abandon Greek, Jack might have the opportunity to learn more practical subjects. Writing to Boucher again, Washington outlined these other subjects. In his letter, he grouped his suggestions in a single paragraph, but they can be separated, numbered, and presented as a set of educational maxims. 1. To be acquainted with the French tongue is become a part of polite education, and to a man who has any idea of mixing in a large circle, absolutely necessary. 2. Without arithmetic, the common affairs of life are not to be managed with success. 3. The study of geometry and the mathematics, with due regard to the branches of it, is equally advantageous. 4. The principles of philosophy, moral, natural, etc., I should think a very desirable knowledge for a gentleman. These words show Washington rethinking precisely what a gentleman's education meant. Formerly, he had accepted the traditional idea that a gentleman's education meant a classical education. Now he considered the skills a gentleman might need in his day-to-day life. Washington remained disappointed that Jack had neglected his education during his years with Boucher. The more he thought about the situation, the angrier he got. By mid-1771, he was tired of Jack's laziness and his excuse-making, and tired, too, of the positive spin Boucher kept putting on the boy's progress. Jack had been studying with Boucher for 3 years, yet it scarcely seemed as if the boy had learned anything more than he had already learned from McGowan. Jack's knowledge may have actually regressed. He had started studying Greek with McGowan, but now he seemed incapable of construing the simplest sentence in Greek. Washington was starting to see Jack's time with Boucher as a huge waste. In terms of classical learning, Boucher had to admit that Jack had learned little since McGowan left Mount Vernon, but in his own defense, Boucher reiterated the argument that a good education involved much more than learning the classics. Boucher had continued to plan a grand tour for Jack. From Washington's perspective, Jack had not learned enough at school to justify a European vacation. After acquiring a knowledge of Latin, students could pick up French rapidly, but Jack, in his stepfather's words, knew nothing of French, which is absolutely necessary to him as a traveler. His reluctance to learn French is another manifestation of Jack's laziness. Not only did he lack the language skills for European travel, Jack simply had not studied hard enough to justify the trip as a reward. No, Washington said once and for all, there would be no grand tour for Jack Custis. Regarding Boucher's central point, that there was more to education than merely becoming a scholar, Washington agreed. Though he was willing to admit that students should study practical subjects they could use as adults, he was still unwilling to abandon the idea of a classical education. Gaps in his own education had made Washington sorely aware of his personal limitations. Though lacking a classical education himself, Washington responded to Boucher, formulating one of the briefest yet most eloquent defenses of traditional learning ever written. I conceive a knowledge of books is the basis upon which other knowledge is to be built. Gallivanting around Annapolis to attend afternoon horse races and evening dress balls, Custis found many ways to occupy his time instead of studying. His wealth gave him entrance to the city's finest residences and helped him expand his personal circle of acquaintances. He befriended Charles Wilson Peale, a local painter at the start of a career that would eventually make him one of the most distinguished portraitists in early America. Having spent 2 years in London studying with Benjamin West, Peale had returned home to seek an American clientele. Custis correctly surmised that his stepfather would be interested in having his portrait painted. Equipped with a letter of introduction from Jonathan Boucher, Peale, accompanied by Jack Custis, arrived at Mount Vernon on May 18, 1772. Washington agreed to have Peale paint his portrait and also arranged for him to paint miniatures of Martha and her children. For his portrait, Washington dusted off his old uniform from the Virginia Regiment which let Peel portray him as a military man. Peel's portrait does not do Washington justice. Though he had turned 40 earlier that year, Washington retained the strength and athleticism of a much younger man, but the picture hardly reveals his fitness. His pose is static and he looks flabby. The waistcoat cannot cover a sizable paunch. With his left hand behind his back and his right tucked into the waistcoat, Washington does not look like a man of action. Peel's personal reminiscence of Mount Vernon paints a much different picture. After his visit, he would frequently relate an anecdote confirming Washington's great physical strength and depicting him as a much more athletic and dynamic figure. Near Mount Vernon one day, Peel had joined some young men competing against each other by pitching the bar. During this traditional athletic contest, competitors hurled a heavy iron bar to see who could throw it the furthest. Sir Walter Scott commemorated this rural sport in verse, observing, "Their arms the brawny yeomen bear to hurl the massive bar in air." As they played in the neighborhood of Mount Vernon, contestants marked their distances with wooden pegs, the furthest one a goal for other contestants to surpass. As they were playing, Washington suddenly appeared among them, asking one of the competitors to point out the furthest peg. They had all stripped to the waist for the competition, but Washington did not bother to bare his brawny arms. Without taking off his coat, he grabbed the bar and hurled it into the air. It struck the ground far beyond the furthest peg. "You perceive, young gentlemen, that my arm yet retains some portion of the vigor of my early days," Washington said with a smile as wide as the Potomac. As he walked away, he told them, "When you beat my pitch, young gentlemen, I'll try again." Leaving Mount Vernon, Peel and Custis went different ways. On Washington's recommendation, Peel headed to Williamsburg, where he hoped to find other distinguished Virginians willing to sit for their portraits. Custis returned to Maryland, but not to Annapolis. In late 1771, Boucher had left Annapolis to become a rector of Queen Anne's Parish in Prince George's County, Maryland, where he reestablished his school. Jack had come with Boucher to his new school. So had another student, Charles Calvert, who was the son of Benedict Calvert of Mount Airy and a direct descendant of the founder of Maryland. Staying with Boucher, Jack may have promised his stepfather to dedicate himself to study, but this he did not do. Given his voluptuous nature, Jack found other things to do in Prince George's County besides study. Charles Calvert's sister Eleanor, or Nellie as she was familiarly known, caught Jack Custis's eye. At 18, he made up his mind to marry her. Washington had made up his mind to send the boy to college before a marriage could take place. But which college? Colonial America now offered several institutions of higher learning. Washington had many factors to consider before he settled on a school for the boy. He wanted the best possible college for his stepson, of course, but location was also a factor. Though George Washington wanted to get Jack away from Nellie Calvert, Martha Washington wanted to keep her son close. Washington decided against William and Mary, not only because of the inattention of the masters, but also because it afforded no pleasing prospect to a youth who has a good deal to attain, but a short while to do it in. After asking around, he concluded that the Philadelphia Academy would be best for Jack, since the Philadelphia Academy de-emphasized classical learning in favor of a more practical education. Jack's resistance toward Latin and Greek would not be an obstacle to his advancement. The first week of January 1773, Washington wrote Boucher, asking if he would write a letter of recommendation for Custis to the Philadelphia Academy. Boucher alternatively suggested King's College, later renamed Columbia. Though disappointed with Boucher's inability to control Jack's behavior and channel the boy's energies toward serious study, Washington still respected his opinion. When Washington learned that Dr. Miles Cooper, the president of King's College, had introduced extensive reforms in terms of both curriculum and discipline, he chose King's College and made preparations to escort his stepson to New York. Washington planned to leave Mount Vernon for New York on Monday, May 10th. Jack left 2 days earlier to visit Nellie Calvert at Mount Airy, where Washington met up with him. Though he still felt that Jack was too young to marry, Washington could hardly complain about his stepson's fiancée. Nellie's family was one of the oldest and most distinguished in Maryland. Nellie personally distinguished herself in terms of charm, intelligence, sensitivity, and wit. After spending Monday night at Mount Airy, George Washington, Jack Custis, and Jack's servant Joe left for New York. They reached New York the last week of May. Washington introduced himself and his stepson to Dr. Miles Cooper, and together they arranged to make Jack's time in college as comfortable as possible. Jack's wealth gave him an advantage over less fortunate students, so he became a favorite among the professors. He even dined with his teachers, a privilege denied to other students. In addition, Jack's apartment was fairly sumptuous for a college student. Here's how he described it to his mother. "I have a large parlor with two studies or closets, each large enough to contain a bed, trunk, and couple of chairs. One I sleep in, and the other Joe calls his." While in New York, Washington took the opportunity to indulge his passion for the theater. On Friday evening, May 28th, he attended a performance of Hamlet. Washington was exposed to Shakespeare in his adolescence. His father had a copy of Shakespeare's plays in his library. Containing an edition of Shakespeare, the Custis Library let him reread Shakespeare whenever he wished. Regardless how well Washington knew his Shakespeare beforehand, the 1773 visit to the Playhouse in New York is the first known time he saw a Shakespeare play performed. Washington's writings reverberate with Shakespearean echoes. In one general order during the Revolutionary War, for example, he encouraged his officers to see themselves as a band of brothers, using a phrase from Henry V. "We few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother." Washington could recite Shakespeare's comedies as well as his history plays. He typically elevated his language when he wrote to others with a literary bent. In a letter to the poet and songwriter Francis Hopkinson, for example, Washington said he had grown more accustomed to sitting for his portrait. Originally, he felt considerable impatience while the painters painted, but now he could "sit like patience on a monument whilst they are delineating the lines of my face." Washington borrowed his simile from a speech Viola makes to Orsino in Twelfth Night. "She pined in thought, and with a green and yellow melancholy she sat like patience on a monument, smiling at grief." Another favorite phrase comes from The Tempest. During the Revolutionary War, Washington found puzzling how the British troops took possession of American towns without conquering American forces and armament. He informed a correspondent, "They well know that it is our arms, not defenseless towns, they have to subdue before they can arrive at the haven of their wishes, and that till this end is accomplished, the superstructure they have been endeavoring to raise, like the baseless fabric of a vision, falls to nothing." He borrowed his simile from a speech Prospero makes in the fourth act of The Tempest. Washington would take the opportunity to see The Tempest performed in Philadelphia during the Constitutional Convention, after which he again repeated Prospero's words. When a correspondent sent him a political pamphlet criticizing his cabinet, President Washington refuted the author's unsubstantiated accusations, observing that Many of his charges are as unsupported as the baseless fabric of a vision. With Jack settled at King's College, Washington left New York the last day of May, riding into a warm south wind. He had one more encounter with higher education this trip. After spending the night at Perth Amboy, he headed for Princeton, where he met the president of the college and future signer of the Declaration of Independence, John Witherspoon. As a personal favor, Washington had agreed to pay the tuition of William Ramsey, Jr., the son of his good friend William Ramsey of Alexandria. Tragedy struck after Washington returned to Mount Vernon. On Saturday, June 19, 1773, Patsy Custis, at 17, had another seizure, this time a fatal one. Patsy suffered what is now labeled sudden unexplained death in epilepsy, SUDEP, during which death occurs from a seizure-associated cardiorespiratory arrest and its ensuing complications. The report Washington made to a family friend the following day is heart-wrenching. She rose from dinner about 4 o'clock in better health and spirits than she appeared to have been in for some time, soon after which she was seized with one of her usual fits and expired in it in less than 2 minutes without uttering a word, a groan, or scarce a sigh. This sudden and unexpected blow, I scarce need add, has almost reduced my poor wife to the lowest ebb of misery. Times of great emotion often inspired Washington's writing, but his description of Patsy Custis's death is not just a sentimental flourish. Washington's account of his stepdaughter's death is now recognized as one of the earliest well-documented eyewitness descriptions of SUDEP. Nellie Calvert, who happened to be visiting Mount Vernon, also witnessed Patsy Custis's death. Her presence was a great comfort to George and Martha Washington. Nellie's good nature helped soothe their heartache. She almost seemed to step into the void created by Patsy's death. Washington still felt his stepson was too immature to marry, but he could take comfort in the kind and sensitive young woman Jack had chosen to wed. Saddened by the news of Patsy's death and lonely from his separation from Nellie, Jack Custis endured college life until September, when he left New York for Mount Vernon. He intended to return to King's College, where he hoped to deepen his study of moral philosophy. To that end, he asked his stepfather to order several books on the subject. But the appeal of married life was too strong for him to resist. On February 3, 1774, John Park Custis and Eleanor Calvert were married during a candlelit nighttime ceremony designed to suit the couple's romantic inclinations. Though George Washington had wanted Jack to finish college first, Martha Washington approved of her son's marriage. As the boy's stepfather, he could only push the issue so far. Martha did think that the wedding came too soon after Patsy's death. Still in mourning for her daughter the first week of February, she thought it would be bad luck to attend her son's wedding ceremony wearing black. She stayed at Mount Vernon while George and Lund Washington, the devoted cousin who would serve as the plantation manager of Mount Vernon for many years, left for Mount Airy to attend the ceremony. Jonathan Boucher thought the marriage to Nellie would provide the kind of stabilizing influence Jack Custis had been unable to find at school. As he told Washington, "Miss Nellie Calvert has merit enough to fix him, if any woman can, and I do, from the fullness of a warm heart, most cordially congratulate his mother and yourself, as well as him, on the happiness of his having made this most pleasing of all connections with this the most amiable young woman I have almost ever known." Boucher's time with Jack Custis influenced his educational theory. In one sermon, he discussed the subject of a classical education. "Instead of indiscriminately compelling all our youth, with or without a genius adapted to such studies, to spend the whole period of education in fruitless attempts, merely, as Milton says, to scrape together a little miserable Greek and Latin, it is much to be wished some discrimination could be made, and that boys hereafter may be taught not words only, but such things as they are best qualified to learn, and such as are likely to be of most use to them in the part they are hereafter to act in the great drama of life. Discussing the educational philosophy of the colonial South, Richard Beale Davis attributed Boucher's new attitude to his maturation as a schoolmaster. Boucher's personal experience suggests a more specific cause. The double challenge he faced, educating Jack Custis and justifying the boy's education in letters to George Washington, helped Boucher rethink his pedagogical approach and devise a more pragmatic educational philosophy. Washington may have failed in his efforts to give his stepson a proper gentleman's education, but his correspondence with his stepson's teacher gave him a forum for contributing to the central debate over American education in the 18th century.